right, here we are. Welcome back to another episode of the Stronger Stride podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, whether this is your first episode or if you've been here for a while. We appreciate you so much. Today is a really exciting episode because we have two guests. So double the fun for you today. We have Kelly Kortick and Blake Withers, who are wonderful practitioners and runners from Newcastle. I met them both when I was living in Newcastle a long time ago, a couple of years now, and they both have a podcast that they share together called The Sports Medicine Project. It's a fantastic podcast. They interview all sorts of researchers and clinicians and surgeons and experts in all sorts of fields in the allied health and sports medicine world. And I know that I personally learn so much from them and really, really look forward to their episodes coming out each week. And I know that if you guys are interested in the topics that we talk about, then I think you'll also really, really enjoy their episodes as well. They're really good at explaining quite complex concepts in a really simplified, easy to digest, easy to understand manner, which we go through today in our bone stress injury chat. So really stoked to have these guys on. I think we'd love to get them on as kind of a semi-regular segment because we've all got kind of different areas that we focus on within our practice, some similar opinions, some different opinions. So it's really nice to open up that conversation and just get us all thinking and progressing and improving as clinicians and coaches and athletes ourselves. So really, really enjoy this conversation. You will notice that Lydia wasn't present for the interview. She couldn't make it for today's episode, so you're stuck with me. But luckily we had both Blake and Kelly to fill the gap a little bit, so that was good. We talked about bone stress injuries in general just briefly. But if you'd like to dive a little bit deeper into more detail around bone stress injuries, then I'll link the episode that Lydia did recently, going really deep into kind of the anatomy, the causes, the risk factors, the treatment, those kind of things for bone stress injuries. But we went over a little bit today, and then we dove really deep on a specific case today, a case study, which was Kelly herself, who has recently had a stress fracture or a stress reaction or periosteum. They're not quite sure exactly what it was. You'll find out in the episode. It's a little bit unclear as to what was actually going on, but she's been managing that a little bit differently to how you would normally manage a bone stress injury because it was not a typical presentation, and she was symptom free. So there was just some changes that she made that was really quite eye opening for her practice as well with her own patients, and really good kind of learning and lessons for all of us to think about, and I guess to consider that we are all individuals and we can kind of use our research and knowledge and also kind of our experiences to shape the best rehab program for ourselves. So as we spoke about in the episode, and Kelly made it quite clear, this is not medical advice. This is not a program that you need to follow. This is simply just one person's experience. And it's one of those things where you don't really know what the outcome or the result is going to be until you've gone through the process. So it's definitely not something that we're advising you doing in terms of following exactly what she's done. But it was just an interesting kind of thought-provoking conversation, and we talked more broadly as well about bone stress injuries in general and more about kind of load management. We talked about deload weeks, and kind of different strategies that we use to deload and why that's so important, and just some general kind of banter and conversation as we do with these guys. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. I know that you will as well. If you haven't already checked out their podcast, we'll have it linked below. It's the Sports Medicine Project. They've got some fantastic episodes and I really, really recommend it. And yeah, I think that's it from me. Thank you so much. Please follow us on Instagram, subscribe, rate 5 stars, all those good things. And I will speak to you next week. Thanks so much, team.
Just come for the chats. That's what I do. I don't contribute much to this podcast.
That's all right. Blake loves it. All right. Welcome back to the Stronger Stride podcast. Thank you so much for joining us once again today. We are very excited. I'm very excited. I think our guests are excited. We have Blake and Kelly on from the Sports Medicine Project. They have a fantastic podcast, which is definitely more, what would I say, intellectual probably than ours.
That's nice. Very nice.
Yeah. Like they have lots of researchers and health professionals that know a lot of stuff, and they both also know a lot of stuff. So I'm very excited to introduce Blake and Kelly. Tell us how you're doing.
Doing good. Yeah, you know, it's a Friday afternoon and I've been looking forward to this. So what does that say? That must say that I'm good. Excited for the chat.
Yeah.
You know, going into the long weekend and kicking it off with a podcast.
Yeah, good, great timing. Very good timing for a podcast.
Well, that's it. What would you rather be doing? I think this is the highlight of the weekend, surely, right here.
Maybe we all need to get lives.
We just love running so much. Yeah. We talk about it all the time. So for the listeners who don't know you, I suggest listening to your podcast. But if you can give them a quick summary of each of you, who you are, and I guess a little bit about your podcast as well, that'd be great.
Am I going to kick it off?
Yeah, you go.
Go, okay. Kelly.
My name is Kelly. I am a physiotherapist in Newcastle. So I work at Newcastle Performance Physio. We predominantly work with, I guess, general population, but we see a lot of runners through the doors and a lot of younger sort of athletic population groups. So a lot of people that are involved in sport, some acute traumatic injuries, some overuse injuries. And yeah, as I said, a lot of runners, which we've sort of worked hard to build up because we just love it that much. I'm lucky enough to have a couple of gyms in the practice that I work at. So a big focus of our work is a lot of active rehab and getting people into the gym as quickly as we can and getting them strong and rehabbed that way rather than in the sort of just clinic room and clinic space. So I'm really lucky and grateful for that. I love going to work every day and I really look forward to the people that I get to see and the people that I get to work alongside of. I also run myself, so very much a recreational runner, but it's a hobby that I'm very passionate about. I look forward to my run probably more than anything else in the day. And what else can I talk about? Is that
podcast?
Oh, yeah, we've got a podcast. We've got a podcast. It's called The Sports Medicine Project. I would say Blake's probably the star of the show and I just really like coming along and chatting to
never heard
people.
Say that before, ever.
I just love learning things and that's my favorite part. I think I learn something every single week from the guests that we speak to. And I think there's always more things that we can learn to better ourselves as clinicians and runners and people. And yeah, that's probably my favorite part about the podcast, generating those conversations and then being able to share it with whoever wants to listen. And the other thing is we've just developed such great networks since starting the podcast. Like the people that we've met and the connections that we've built through the podcast have just been amazing. Like it's so great that we can just message, you know, Rich Willie and ask him a question. That's just selfishly just so, so great. And I love it.
Yeah. And you guys are an example. You and Lydia and the Strongest Ride.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Good conversations.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, I still remember when you guys started and it's so cool to see how many amazing guests you've had on and all the cool conversations you have. And Kelly, I know that you said that Blake's the star of the show and that he does some of the background work, but the banter would not be there if you weren't there.
Yeah,
I said that to Blake, actually. I was like, people like the debate. You can't get rid of me.
I don't think you've been arguing enough lately. I reckon we need a bit more.
Yes, I agree. I was saying that. Bring it back to the OG days.
Gossip. Yeah, it's been too politically correct. Let's get some arguments happening. A couple of swear words for good measure.
Yeah. Kelly and I are together, by the way. Like, she's my partner.
Oh, yeah. We forget to tell people sometimes people and they're like, your dynamic's weird.
It's a weird co-home for all. And I was like, yeah, we're actually together, but it's right. Yeah. So I'm similar to Kelly. I work in a predominantly sports with an active people. I'm a sports podiatrist, work up in Newcastle. Myself and Dustin Smith, who work with a bunch of doctors at our clinic at the stadium. I lecture and teach at Newcastle Uni in biomechanics and orthoses and podiatry related stuff. And yeah, we co-host the Sports Medicine Project, which is awesome. And I just really love learning and educating. I just think it's awesome. And I just think it's continued to update. And like, we're going to talk about bone stress injuries, but anything like tendons and running and just the research is really coming along, which is awesome. So we try to keep up to date with that and translate to definitely clinicians, but also runners and people that just want to learn about, you know, their bodies and injuries and things like that, which is something that we find pretty awesome.
Yeah, I love it. I love the passion. And I also really appreciate how much effort you guys put into keeping up to date with the research, because I, for one, I could say I'm too busy, but obviously it's just not a priority for me to be on top of all the research at all times. But the posts that you guys put together and the people you have on the podcast help to, I'm being at least pointing at Blake. Well, you're a team. You're a duo. He couldn't do it without you.
When you're backing the last social media post.
I had this awesome idea. I was like, so every Tuesday we're going to do like a female-specific sports medicine post. Kelly was like 4 weeks in a row, a couple of good weeks, a couple of not so good weeks, and then it just stopped. And then that kind of, and it's hard for me to talk about that stuff. But we did have a women's physio on and Kelly wasn't there, so I had to talk about lots of things. But it's been good. It's been fun.
Yeah, we need more of Kelly. Maybe Kelly can do some like Instagram stories, having a chat. I think we need more.
Yeah.
I hate social media.
Oh, okay.
I hate it. I'm just saying it. I don't like it.
All right.
I like the audio. I love the conversation. Okay. I think that's really fun. Mm-hmm. I just don't like being in front of social media.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's just personal preference.
Yeah.
I tried it. I tested it.
It is cool. What I find, I don't know if you find this as well, so if like certainly talking about something, it makes you to this point where you do want to learn about it if you're going to speak about it. Like if I'm about to talk on social media or on a podcast about something, I really want to be as well versed as possible. Like that, you guys did an awesome episode. Well, you did an awesome episode yourself on the double threshold days.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and like just something like that. Like that's, you've got to know about it to talk about it, which I find really cool with having this kind of education platform. Is it kind of does make you want to learn for better or for worse.
Yeah, well, I think it really highlights any areas that you don't know as soon as you start. Like a few times I've started to do a podcast and I'm like, and I just blank. I'm like, I don't actually know what the answer is to that. So then you've got to dive into it and research a little bit more. So yeah, definitely kind of highlights what you need to work on. I think like I've always been someone who has typically not liked speaking in front of groups and things like that. But when it's a topic that you are passionate about and you kind of know a little bit about, you can just, I don't know, I feel way more confident to speak about it. So it definitely helps to have that background knowledge. And then I think you can just deliver it a little bit more clearly and explain it a little bit easier for people to understand, which I think you guys do really well.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
Cool. All right. So today we're going to go through some stuff about bone stress injuries. Now, Lydia did a really fantastic episode not long ago, which you guys can check out. We'll link below, basically an overview of bone stress injuries. But what I wanted to go through specifically today was what Kelly's been through in the last couple of months with her bone stress injury. But if one of you want to give the listeners a quick overview of what actually is a bone stress injury, and I guess kind of why does it occur in runners, you can choose who goes first. I feel like we need a some sort of system. Who's going to answer?
You go and then I'll correct you.
As we were just talking about before, I did really prepare for this as in depth as possible. So I've got a couple of different levels to it, but they're very, very basic. Elevator pitch level one.
That's what we need. Basic. Yes, it's Friday. It's Friday afternoon.
When you do any kind of loading, your bone will get damaged. That's very clear. It's micro damage. It's very small. We need a microscope to see that. At any one stage in your life, you can have up to a million of these little micro damages all over your body, which is pretty cool. Now, your body being the awesome thing that it is able to repair that damage. And as a result, that area then becomes stronger. So you have this relationship and this kind of sequential thing happening throughout your whole life. And obviously when we run, we accumulate damage. And then if we have enough time to recover, new bone gets laid down and then we have stronger bone. So that's basically the way that bone forms. So generally a bone stress injury happens when there is an imbalance between this relationship. You're damaging it too much at the point to it can repair.
Nice. How do you go, Kelly?
What do you think, Kelly? That's level one. What do you
think? Out of 10?
Was okay. I practiced in the car, just drove for 2 hours. I was like, I know this question's coming up. The hand gestures, that kind of thing. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think that was really good. I agree. Sorry, Soph. I agree. I guess to go into I guess to expand on that a little bit.
Level two.
The way that a injury would happen would be when, as Blake mentioned, when you're exceeding what your bone can repair. So you have little cells that are within your bones that are responsible for taking away dead bone and then repairing the new bone. So what typically happens when a bone stress injury occurs is there's been a spike in your training load. So there's more of the cells that come around to the bones and remove the damaged bone. There's actually a lag for the repair cells to catch up. So that lag can be anywhere from about 3 to 10 weeks for them to catch up. Now, if you haven't adjusted that spike in training load and given your body the appropriate amount of time or load managed appropriately enough for the osteoblast to then come in and catch up, then that's when the bone becomes very vulnerable. And that's when you can start to develop a stress reaction or eventually a stress fracture. So that's the tricky part about bone stress injuries is that typically the injury actually, I guess, has been festering away for potentially 3 to 10 weeks before a person might develop symptoms or before that stress reaction or stress fracture actually becomes present. So, and that at that point, it's almost a little bit too late in some ways, and that person really does need to be deloaded appropriately. So that's why it's so important for us to have specific rest weeks or deload weeks in our training to try and give our body that appropriate amount of time to catch up to repair that micro damage that has occurred, as Blake was explaining.
Mm. When you damage the bone, Kelly mentioned that the cells, the osteoclasts, they come in to take away the bone. And the big thing it seems is when those osteoclasts come in to remove the bone, when they take it away, the bone is inherently weaker, or it has an increased amount of porosity for a short period of time. And then before the new bone gets laid down, that's when there's that lag. So The osteoclast, it's generally 3 to 5 weeks, but the actual osteoblast, new bone formation, that can take anywhere from 3 months to 1 year to fully mineralize. And the good thing is this is happening all over the body. So let's say at one spot, you might have the bone remodeling happening and you've got the bone being taken away. The bone might be weaker there, but right next door, you may have bone that's actually fully mineralized. So you're not inherently weaker. It's happening all over the body at different stages.
Which is really cool. Yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's a really nice overview, and I think that makes a really clear picture. Was there another level, or did Kelly cover all that? Because that was,
I guess,
great detail.
The loop.
Level four.
Yeah, we're going deep.
Before. Yeah.
There's no ceiling tonight.
Yeah.
Well, we might talk about this. We might get into this a little bit more later, but I guess there's also differences in the bone sites. So depending on where that bone stress injury is occurring, there might be different things that could be influencing it, and why that particular area of bone might be more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's pretty simple. It's just an imbalance between bone being laid down, but it is a normal process. It's just when it kind of gets out of hand.
I was alluding
a bit
to the trabecular versus cortical bone situation.
I always like to tell, I speak about bone stress injuries a bit. I always like to tell people these really cool stats. In roughly 10 years, your whole skeleton will be completely new bone. So it's continuing to remodel, which is really, really awesome. Mm-hmm. And your bone is really a lot determined what you did when you were younger, and also your genetics, which I guess we're going to touch on, when there's lots of factors that influence the bone. So I just really like those cool stats. So up to 80 to 85% of your bone porosity can be genetic, plus obviously other factors as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask then as well, because you mentioned obviously that imbalance and that training load spike is a really big trigger and a big contributor. Genetics obviously is another thing, but are there other kind of risk factors that the runners should be kind of looking out for or being mindful of, or maybe some people who are listening who might be at a higher risk and therefore need to consider these things a little bit more deeply?
Oh, there's so many risk factors.
How deep are we going? How many levels this time?
Yeah, level 8 this time. I'll talk about one that I think is really interesting, and I know which one you're going to talk about because I know you that well. And that's one of the interesting ones as well.
I'm going to throw a spanner in the works.
No, I know you're not going to talk. So the biggest risk factor of all time, which is clearly number one, is if you've had a previous bone stress injury, which can be stress fracture, stress reaction, bony edema, you are at increased risk of having one again. But the one that I think is really cool, and I love bones. I just think they're so easy to think about. Like if you think of just like a plank of wood, right, as your tibia or your femur, obviously it's more complex than that, but the shape of that plank of wood is obviously going to determine how much load it can take. So some people genetically just have thicker bones. They might have bigger bones. Their bones might have developed a lot more when they were younger because they did a lot of multi-directional sport. So they're going to have a thicker bone. So our anatomy and our biomechanics can really play into it. And a really easy example to think about, and I'm talking about the foot because it's the best part of the body. the second toe, your second metatarsal, if you have a longer second metatarsal, you are at an increased risk of having a second metatarsal stress reaction. And the reason we think that is longer bone, it's going to be more susceptible to tensile force when we bend it. And you think of a stick, if it's shorter or longer, it's a lot easier to break the longer stick because it's less able to tolerate that tensile force. So your anatomy and biomechanics do play into it for some people. I just think that's really interesting.
Mm. Yeah, I like it. That's a good one. Kelly, any other risk factors?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of what one you think I'm going to say, which I think you know, but I'm going to say a different one.
Well, it's an important one. And I know Sophie and Lydia have talked about it plenty as well. I think it's one of the most important.
I'm picking up what you're putting down. So relative energy deficiency in sport is another big risk factor for bone stress injuries. So essentially what that means is if a person has a low energy availability, meaning they are not they are either training more than they're eating, or they're not eating enough to fuel their training, or Is that the two? They're the
yeah.
two. Then, yeah, I thought there was a third one in there.
There's only two levels.
There's two levels. I'm like, it can't flip any other direction. Then you are in a state of low energy availability. Now, when that happens, your body is prioritizing the more important parts of the body. So it's prioritizing the brain. It's prioritizing your digestive function. It's prioritizing all of the other systems within the body. It starts to shut down the things that it doesn't need to have going on in the background. Now, your endocrine system or your hormonal system can also be part of that. So that's when women might start to lose their menstrual cycle because they're not their hypothalamus and pituitary glands are not talking to their ovaries, and the messages are not going through for them to be getting that normal menstrual cycle. In males, it might look like not getting a morning erection. So I think it's five, if they're not getting a morning erection five mornings of the week, then that might be an indication of low energy availability.
3 to 5, and that's from Renny Mubrega. There actually isn't any published research on that, but that's Renny Mubrega's kind of general rule of thumb, which is interesting.
And then I guess on that note as well, so as I said, your body's prioritizing what it needs to for you to be able to get through the day and function. So your bones are very metabolically active, so they're requiring a lot of energy to turn over that new bone and for them to repair. Now, there's certain bones in our body that are more trabecular-rich bones. Now, trabecular-rich bones are very metabolically active, and they require a very high amount of energy for them to be repairing. Now, trabecular bones are typically the bones that are more proximal. So you're thinking like your neck of femur, your sacrum, your lumbar spine. They're made of more trabecular-rich bone. If you're seeing a bone stress injury in any of those areas, then your indexes of suspicion for someone being in a state of red S is probably a little bit higher compared to cortical bones. So that might be like your metatarsals or your tibia or your fibula, which there might be more of an indication that it's due to specifically training load or biomechanics or something like that. There can, of course, be overlap, and you certainly aren't ruling out that relative energy deficiency in sport might be contributing, but particularly in those trabecular-rich bone sites.
Yeah, and like a general rule of thumb, if some of the bones don't make sense of where they are, it's like the further away you get from the foot, perhaps relative energy deficiency in sport may be more indicated. Generally, if you're at the foot, it may be more biomechanics anatomy because there's more cortical bone in those bad boys down there.
Yeah, nice. I like it. That's good. I think there are probably some really key factors for our listeners to think about.
Early sports specialization, I think, is another really key one. And I thought that's what you were going to be talking about, actually. So maybe I don't know you as well.
No, I knew you were going to go right
So basically what that means is if someone is specializing in their sport when they're in their adolescent years,
prepubescent
years, then you're not getting as much of that multi-directional loading and multi-directional stress when your bones are developing. So they're the crucial years for bone development, for your body to really be laying down that thick, strong, dense bone. And the recommendation is that kids should be involved in 3 different types of sports to be developing their skeleton as much as they can. So there is an increased risk for individuals if they have only been involved in 2, I think, or less sports when they were prepubescent.
Yeah. Did you touch on menstrual dysfunction as well with red S? Mm. You did. I know you mentioned the male, you mentioned female as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did I?
Yes, so. You did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was listening, don't worry.
I thought you did. I was like, that's it's important, especially if you're a clinician listening to this. Like, that is an important question to ask a female. If you're a male, it's not a taboo topic. It is really, really important to have that, you know, sent or addressed by the right people, which is generally a dietitian or sports doc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good one. Awesome. All right, Kelly, let's talk a little bit about your specific case. I know you've had stress reaction or stress factor in the past. But tell us a little bit about what's been going on with you over the last, I don't know, what are we up to now? 5 or 6 months? Has it been that long?
No, it's been not very long at all. It has been like 6 weeks.
Oh, no way.
Yeah,
since MRI.
6 weeks since I, yeah.
Since you did a surf. So you did a surf this weekend.
Oh, wow.
6 weeks this weekend, I think.
Okay.
Or maybe 7 weeks this weekend. So it hasn't been that long, actually.
No, but you've just been progressing quicker than we would have expected. So tell us a little bit about
anyone
that.
Anyone could have hoped in the world, medical marvel over here with this femur.
Yeah. What are your genes? Get you in the lab.
It's funny you say that, because I was going to actually say, in terms of those risk factors, I probably have all of them.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm a female sex. I actually didn't have sports specialization. I played heaps of sports when I was younger. Blake reckons my biomechanics is all messed up because of my cavus feet, but
does have a cavus foot. However, I need to just clear the record, because people are thinking, podiatry, this guy's going to say foot posture is everything. But foot posture has not clearly been shown to increase the risk of having stress reaction fractures. So if you've got flat feet, high arches, or everything in between, do not worry.
You're all good.
You're good
all
save.
Good. You're all good. My cavus feet are not a problem.
What else have you got?
I was going through a period of bad recovery and stress and things like that. We were buying a house, so, you know, that comes with all of that baggage. Mm-hmm. Had a high training load, was building for the Sydney Marathon, have had a prior bone stress injury, and don't have menstrual dysfunction or redness at the moment, but I have had that in the past for a pretty extended period of time, and menstrual dysfunction for like 8 years. So I think that's
ticking all the boxes.
Solid, risk factor there. So yeah, tick all the boxes. I'm at a high risk. I'm aware of that, and something that I just need to be really careful of.
Can I just quickly touch on the high training load one? Because that's an interesting, if you increase your volume just by jogging very slowly, it's almost like a one-to-one ratio of your risk of an injury or a bone stress injury. But the thing with high training load that seems to load bone the most is the magnitude of loading. So if you're doing lots of intensity, that exponentially increases your risk of an injury. So you were doing more sessions, you're doing longer sessions and certainly more strides. You were doing a Tuesday session plus a Thursday tempo.
Yeah, I was doing more like a marathon pace tempo on Thursday.
Yeah, which you haven't usually done either. Consistently with an increase.
Not at that volume.
Just want to touch on that, because you can, the intensity is a big one.
Definitely.
Yeah, I also want something. Oh, sorry,
you go.
I was just going to say, I think that's something I'd be keen to talk about as well after this is, how do we like monitor that training load? Because I think a lot of people go off Strava kilometers. But obviously if you were just looking at kilometers, then how would you know that the intensity has changed? No?
You go to Strongest Ride and you get Soph as a coach and to do your run testing too, which we've both done.
Great. Mm.
That's one way to do it.
Yeah, for sure. I want to preface as well, like, this is my experience and
Are you comfortable?
Give me a look then. This is my experience, my injury. This doesn't apply to everyone all the time. So what I've done and how I've managed this isn't right for everyone. And there's certainly scenarios where I'd be managing this very differently. So just to preframe. Mm-hmm.
Not medical advice, really. Just an experience. I guess
I'm talking about this from patient perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, my physio brain came into it at times, but yes, this is certainly my own experience.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So you got the MRI. What happened leading up to that? What were you feeling? What kind of symptoms were you having? Did you kind of know straight away that something was going on, or what did that initial stage look like?
So I was
pretty, on the Saturday,
pretty deep into my marathon training program, and we were I think we were 5 weeks out from the Sydney Marathon, so pretty well at the peak of where it was going to get to. I had no symptoms whatsoever until I did a 5 kilometer fast run. So I was aiming for a PB, which I successfully got through. So fastest I've ever ran.
It's all
ran.
Worth it.
Sub 20 as well, which is like a big milestone that I've been aiming for a while. And
second person in the house to go under sub 20. we were
that old.
That was back in the day. That was real fit.
Had no pain during that run whatsoever, no symptoms, nothing at all. Cooled down, didn't have any worries during the cool down either. And then got home and I was like to Blake, I've got a bit of a pain through the middle portion of my thigh. And I was like, oh, fuck, hope that's not a bone stress injury. Mm. Like, kind of knowing that there's not much else that could really be in that area. I was like, I don't think I've torn my quad. Like, it doesn't feel like that. We were jokingly around the house, just like doing some hopping, and Blake did the fulcrum test on my leg.
Yeah.
Fulcrum test was fine. Hopping was sore.
Which are like all bone stress injury tests.
Yeah. And we were going down to Sydney that afternoon to run the City to Surf the next day. We were just going to use it as a long run. So we weren't planning on racing it or doing anything quick, or I wasn't anyways. And we were watching the Matildas game, walk down there, and I was able to, like, I could feel it every step. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I should be doing this run tomorrow. Like, I'm fully aware of this. And woke up the next morning, it was still a little bit sore, didn't have any pain through the night or anything like that, but woke up that morning and it was still a bit sore, and I kind of ummed and ahed about if I should do it or not. I was very conflicted. I kind of felt like I had a bit of an angel and a devil sitting on my shoulder, angel being like, don't do it, be sensible, the marathon's the main goal, and then the devil's like, you're probably being a hypochondriac, because I am a catastrophizer. Let me just put that out there.
Well, especially when you know so much about it as well. Like, I feel like you're so much more likely to overthink it when you know what it could be. Like, if you had no idea, you'd be like, oh, I just got a sore leg.
Yeah, it's a blessing and a curse. I said that to Blake. I was like, if I didn't know what I knew, I'd be like, my quad's a bit tight. That would be the feeling.
Yeah.
And so we were planning on running, I think, like 10 kilometers before City to Surf, and then doing City to Surf. And I said to Blake, I was like, oh, we'll just jog it. And if it warms up, then I'm not worried about it. It'll be fine. And so we went off, and it did. It warmed up completely. It warmed up probably after maybe a kilometer or two. And I had no pain whatsoever. No issues. We did about 10 kilometers before, did City to Surf, did maybe like 3 or 4 kilometers afterwards. It was 28 kilometer long run. And I felt nothing at all the whole entire run. It felt really good, just jogged. It was a great day, great community. Running's the best. The people around the running community is amazing. We've never done City to Surf before. And it was just
so much fun.
Such a vibe, so great. And then we were sitting on the train and I was like, my leg's sore.
Oh, no.
And then it just got worse the rest of that day. Like, the whole rest of the day, I was like, it's sore. Blake was probably like watching me just continually like rub my leg, being like, I don't know about that. And then I think it was the next day, I was like, I'm not doing anything for the next 2 days or 3 days or 4 days. I think I didn't do anything. Blake works with some sports doctors. So we had some conversations with the sports doctor about the concern, and he sorted out an MRI. And that was on the Thursday that I got the MRI. So it was pretty quick after I first experienced symptoms. And I wonder if that was maybe a problem, like maybe I shouldn't have had it so soon, just because there might have been more of that edema that might not be sort of clinically relevant, because I'll read out to you what the MRI did say.
You had bilateral tibial stress fractures, and I remember when that happened, everything was stress reaction.
Not bilateral.
Everything was fine. You went out for a run and come home and said, my shins are really sore. Like, that was just sudden onset, really painful.
Yeah, in like that both times, like, haven't had any problems at all, and then it just come on. So this is the MRI result. So extensive bone marrow edema can be seen in the left femur, extending from femoral neck all the way down to distal femoral shaft for a length of about 38 centimeters. There is cortical bone thickening along the femoral shaft. Appearance would be in keeping with chronic bone stress reaction. No stress fracture at this stage. Minimal effusion at left hip joint.
Wow.
Is the MRI. I'm not a tall person, 38 centimeters.
I was thinking, like, is your thigh even that long? Like, that's long.
That's and huge. Yeah, so like, that was the result. Like, we were looking at the image before the report came out, and we were like, oh, I don't really know what we're looking at, not knowing that the whole thing was just swollen, basically.
And we did a post on our Instagram when I've got like the MRI images on there, if anyone wants to go and check them out.
That's what
it looks like. It's just the whole thing where it's just white in the middle, which is indicative of bony edema.
So spoke to the sports doctor and got a CT scan as well, just to, because he was quite concerned about the extensiveness of the bone edema and didn't have any stress fractures. He was also just based off my history of Reds, did the whole workup in regards to blood tests and everything like that, and completely normal, like everything was healthy ranges, which what I was quite concerned about, actually. I was like, oh no, everything's gonna go to shit. But it was good. Yeah, I was really happy that all of that was actually quite normal. Yeah, so that was in that sort of first week. And yeah, that was the diagnosis.
Yeah, wow. And then I guess what was your decision making when deciding what sort of rehab to do or how to structure that? I know that you guys had a bit of a discussion about it. How did you kind of make that decision and kind of progress your rehab maybe a little bit quicker than you typically would have?
Yeah, so the advice from the sports doctor was 6 weeks off running, and we actually went to one of the imaging meetings. So I think this might have been like 2 or 3 weeks after that. We went to an imaging meeting, which was with the musculoskeletal radiologist and a few other sports doctors. We pulled up that image, and there was a bit of a discussion actually around maybe it being a little bit more like periosteal reaction, is that being the more symptomatic part. Like, there wasn't too much concern about the bone edema. And my thoughts was because of how diffuse it was. Like, often with a stress reaction, it might be more as a hot spot, or there might be a more localized patch of bone edema, not that diffuse swelling throughout the entire bone, particularly after, like, when I'm at the peak of my marathon training, had been running, you know, almost 80 kilometers a week sort of thing. So quite a decent amount of mileage there. Discussions with those other professionals kind of got me thinking a little bit more about what I'm going to do and why. I definitely listened to the sports doctor for the first, you know, 3 weeks. I didn't do any running. I was doing a little bit of cycling and swimming, and just basing my strength training off symptoms. So I've been consistently doing strength training for ever, basically. And I had decided to increase that to about 3 times a week for this injury. So was more than happy to continue loading my bone as symptoms were tolerated. In the first week and a half, it was painful with walking. So I wasn't going to be doing any heavy squats or even any, I don't think I even did any like bodyweight squats or deadlifts, lunges, nothing like that. I think I just did calf raises for about the first week and a half. And then when it started to settle down, I started to reintroduce some squats just to a box to start with. So reducing the range to limit how much it was stressing the bone. Same thing for deadlifts. I was doing more of like a rack pull just to reduce the range and limit how much stress and load was going through the bone. I continued to load calf raises and tried to keep them quite heavy. I think that conversation with the other professionals was towards the end of that second week, so almost towards that third week. And by that point, I'd actually been symptom free for about a week and a half or a week or so. And I started around the house. I was just trying a little bit of jumping and a little bit of hopping, and I wasn't experiencing any pain or problem through that. So I started to have a few more conversations with some other clinicians. So Nikki Manville's one of my friends and mentors that I bounce heaps of ideas off. She's an amazing clinician, and I trust her a lot. She's very experienced sports physiotherapist as well. And we were talking about it, about, you know, maybe treating this more on symptoms rather than strict timeframes. There's a really good paper by Stuart Warden and Rich Willey. I think it was the 2020 paper, and it's about the management of bone stress injuries. And the recommendation in that paper is for low-grade, low-risk bone stress injuries that once you've had a week of symptoms completely free, then you can begin walking. So that's pretty much what I did. So I just started taking myself on a walk. So I think I started with 30 minutes and then went to about 45 minutes and then an hour. And again, had no pain during or afterwards or at night or anything like that. And then at that 3 week mark, it had been over a week of being symptom free. I'd been walking for an hour without any problems, had been squatting, I think up to, 30 or 40 kilos without any problems, started to introduce skipping again. So I thought I'm going to try a gradual return to running a little bit earlier than recommended by the sports doctor, just based off the information that I'd gathered and it being my decision for what I thought was best for me. So then we had a bit of a debate about that. Blake wasn't too keen initially for me to do that, but I think now you're probably glad that I did.
I don't know. I'm still on the fence.
Blake, do you want to explain kind of your reservations behind that, or why you thought it maybe wasn't the best idea?
Yeah, I think just because from what we understand, bone takes takes time to adapt, and we can't always, I guess, anticipate how quickly things are going to change. And my reservation was, Kelly gets a lot out of running and she really enjoys running, which is awesome. But I think for a short period of time, the need to get back to running, could we have just substituted that for another 3 weeks, which we would know, I think we could say you would have a significantly less risk of it flaring back up again, or potentially having a bone stress injury. Not to say that you would have, but I think that may have just lessened the risk. And because if you've got a lot of risk factors for other bone stress injuries, your risk is higher. Like, that is clear. You have a higher risk of having a bone stress injury. So we need to be perhaps a little bit more reserved. And I'm obviously biased because I'm your partner, but I thought that it would have been a bit better to be a bit more reserved. But in saying that, you've been completely fine, then I don't want to say that just because you've been fine, that means that everyone should be like that. And then we're certainly not recommending that. But there's a couple of risk factors. And the reason to get back, I think, just because you really enjoy running, which we both do, but could you have just taken 3 weeks to have a little bit more of a rest and then let the bone remodel and change and perhaps increase its strength?
So I don't think having extended periods of time off anything is a good idea, though.
But off running, so you can still so you can still swim.
Well, that's what I mean. Even off running, I think having an extended period of time off running when you don't need to is potentially putting yourself up at risk for developing other injuries when you are returning to running. And I know it's going to be gradual, but I just don't think that having big sort of like peaks and troughs, like we see that with patients when there's that lack of consistency with their program, whether it be running or soccer or cycling, then that's when things can start to pop up, when niggles can start to happen. I think you're better off with them keeping some a level of capacity and some mileage in the legs if they can. We know that with tendons too. Like, if we can keep
different.
Someone
it's,
running,
it's different then, though. Tendons have a different physiology than bone. You can't say it's like, we're saying apples are like oranges. Tendons are different to bone. That is really clear. And we know how bone remodels and it takes time. It's why bone injuries can just come out of nowhere. You have to have new bone laid down, that kind of thing.
So in that Stuart Warden paper, the recommendation is that when it is a low-risk bone site, you can gradually start to return someone to running when they've been symptom-free for a week and they're able to walk for 30 minutes without pain or symptoms.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's the wrong thing. I'm just saying to me, the risk was higher and I couldn't justify that risk.
Okay.
That was all.
There we go. That's what we've been looking for.
We have had this. This is our household every single. No, it's not so much. But I do admit, initially, my mind has definitely changed from where it was initially. I was like, no, you have to rest. But now I'm like, I was probably thought about it the wrong way. I do admit that, definitely.
Mm.
But it's just, I think, I mean, you would probably have this as well. So if you, as clinicians, and we know our experiences can shape how we feel, I am a little bit more concerned and reserved for people because I see bone stress injuries in the clinic all the time, and it has such an impact on people's lives. They can't run, they perhaps can't spend time with their friends who also run. It's such a big chunk of their life. And I'm like, if I can perhaps make some recommendations that potentially reduce your risk of you missing more time off, maybe I do want to do that. And obviously having the conversation with them, I think that's where my mind comes from.
But do you think you're reducing their risk by having more time off running when they could be maintaining a higher tolerance to running by getting back earlier?
I think if you're saying that they can have a high tolerance to running, I think they can maintain the same level of loading for their bone without running. And it's a lot more, I can control that a lot more, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Sophie? I actually haven't spoken to anyone on the live audio. What would you have done if that was your leg? What do you think?
It's so hard to know. I think for me personally, I would have struggled. Like, I would have preferred, obviously, like we all would have, to get back to running sooner. Mm-hmm. I would have struggled having the time off if I thought that there was a chance that I didn't need it off.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to, I don't know if you guys know Soto, I was on his podcast the other day.
Yeah.
We were speaking about, like, if you just told me, like, just take a week off running for not really any purpose, but just to have a week off, because I haven't had a week off in, I don't know, years. Like, I think I would really struggle with that. So mm-hmm. if there was a possibility of still being able to run, then I think I would always choose that option. But then it's so hard to know, because you just don't know until it's too late, kind of thing.
It's really funny that you say that, Soph, because at the start I was like, this is such an easy injury to deal with. This is so black and white. Mm. I just need to have 6 weeks off running and then I can start a gradual return to run. Like, there's no beating around the bush. It is what it is.
Yeah.
And then after that imaging meeting, like, that's what really got me thinking. They were like, oh, it kind of looks just a bit periosteum irritation. Like, I'd almost grade that as a grade one or a grade two on the Fredrickson scale.
Mm.
And so I was immediately like, oh, can I run?
Yeah. As soon as there's like a slither of hope, you like grasp it. Like, I think it is interesting, because I know Lydia's had a few instances where she's not been sure whether she's had a stress fracture or reaction or something else. And she's had the scan and you're like waiting for the results, thinking like, oh, I hope it is a stress fracture, because at least then I'll know exactly what it is. I'll know exactly what to do about it. But if it's not that, it's like, it just becomes confusing. Yeah. So there is something nice about it being straightforward and simple, but obviously it just never is really that straightforward. I don't know, but it sounds like you've made the right decision. So,
well, we don't know.
We don't know yet. Too soon to know.
Yeah, as we're saying, that those osteoclasts, you're still in that phase. I think you said that the periosteum, for people that are listening, like an elevator pitch of that, you've got bone, and then you've got coating around it, and essentially the easiest way to think about it, and that's called the periosteum, and it's really like a plastic, and that periosteum is really highly innervated, and it can get quite sore and painful, and you can get some fluid and inflammation of that periosteum rather than the actual bone. So there's a bit of a differentiating factor between like periostitis and a bone stress injury. And you get there some shin splints as well. So what the case was is, when it's more the periosteum, perhaps you can continue to run on it and just treat it almost like a tendon. Whereas when it's the bone, you know, it's a bit more black and white.
But then we don't know if that can lead to bone stress injuries.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Bit of a tricky.
Oh, it's tricky. Area. It's interesting. It'd be cool to see how things progress. And I'm assuming everything's still feeling really good and you're just continuing to progress things.
It does make you think how many people, you know, with these injuries, and we're big advocates, you know, you don't really need to stop running for many injuries at all, but how many people perhaps could have kept some running volume and didn't have to take that much time off. And as you were saying, what did that potentially lead to later on if they had 6 weeks off and then getting back into running?
Well, I think I've changed how I practice a little bit based off this. And I don't want to say that because I don't want my experience to completely shape it, but not necessarily my experience, but just the learning that I've done around it, I suppose, around maybe treating bone stress injuries a little bit more symptom based rather than these strict time frames, because they are somewhat arbitrary. Like when someone's just thrown a time frame at you for managing a bone stress injury, the caveat to that I'd say would be the high risk ones. I do think that the high risk bone stress injury sites, you really do have to follow strict instruction, and that's really important. They'll often get re-scanned to make sure that there is signs of healing happening there.
Mm-hmm.
But in the low risk sites, I do think we might have a little bit more flexibility. And yeah, this is probably something that I've actually started to implement. I've had a couple of patients with bone stress injuries over the last few weeks, and I've had this discussion with them, and I back it. I think it's sensible. I don't think that it's being reckless, and I don't think it's being risky. As you said, like there's a risk to returning to running at any point, really. But I think if you're getting the important things right, your diet's going well, you're recovering well, you're prioritizing all of those, you know, key things, then I think we can, you know, treat the person based on their symptoms, not just on these arbitrary time frames.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I think we know how much people vary and how much individual differences there are between people. And if we're so specific with everything else, I think it, yeah, we're almost maybe being naive to just be like, no, everyone is 6 weeks or 12 weeks or whatever the time frame is. Like, I think having that individuality makes so much sense. We do it with everything else, but yeah, I guess it's just one of those risky ones, right? Like, you just would hate to mess it up. So it sounds as though you've got the research, you've got the experience. I think, yeah, combining those two, you can't go too wrong, right? You just got to, yeah, not get carried away, right? Like, you're still paying attention to symptoms. If things change, you're obviously going to change what your plan is. So I think being adaptable to that makes a lot of sense. So
yeah, absolutely. I'm on board. And like, I guess with, even if it's someone has followed the 6 week time frame, when you're returning someone to running, you're still having conversations with them about the possibility that a flare up could happen. And if a flare up does happen, it's not back to 6 weeks of time off. You're typically recommending for someone to have, you know, 2 days off, avoid any impact over that 2 day period, and then complete the last walk run interval that you got through without pain or symptoms, and then continue to progress yourself through. So I still think that that's what you would do, even if you did start someone maybe a little bit earlier. And for me, if I flared up now, I would do that. I'd have 2 days off and then I'd go back a step essentially, and then just keep working my way through my return to running. Is that what's your thoughts on that?
Well, let's say you do get, you are returning to running quickly. You can, and I think we had this discussion before, you could still get back to a normal level of volume and intensity, and you could be closer to the threshold for an injury compared to if you had more time off. So let's say your threshold might be, and people can't see my my hand right now, but let's say your threshold for an injury was a lot, you know, you've got a bit of a buffer zone, but then if you come back quicker, you might not be getting symptoms and you don't have an adequate rest, and the bone turnover relationship is getting smaller and smaller, perhaps you are closer to that threshold. I don't know the answer to that. I'm just trying to play as much devil advocate as possible.
I think the takeaway and the learning point for me and what I, the mistake that I think I, the big mistake that I think I made, and the thing that I'm going to be careful of with my return to running program, is appropriate deload week. So I had sort of started doing my own programming, and I was trying to give myself flexibility around the fact that, you know, we were going away for a wedding in 2 weeks' time. So I was going to delay my deload week until then, instead of having it when I probably should have. And I was moving that sort of stuff around, and same thing for like, the return to, I think that was a big thing, because I remember like 2 weeks prior to that wedding, I was like, oh, I'm so tired. I want this week to be my deload week, but I'm going to push through and I'm going to have it in a couple weeks time, because we're going away and I'm not going to get as much running in that week, and we're going to be at a wedding and all of that sort of stuff. So I think that was a mistake, a very clear mistake that I recognize now. And I think that's something that I'm going to be very conscious of now, is having a deload week every third or fourth week, for what we spoke about at the start of this podcast, like really giving my body that chance to catch up. And it's something that I do for my patients when I program for them religiously, and I do it for any runners that I do training programs for. I'll have those clear deload weeks in their schedule, so I don't know why I thought I could get away with it. Not as invincible as I thought.
What do your deload weeks look like when you are programming them for people or for yourself? Are you dropping volume? Are you dropping intensity? How does that kind of look like for the listeners who are like, what's a deload week? Should I just have a week off? What does that actually practically, obviously it's different for everyone, but some kind of principles around deloading?
I'll go first because I'm shorter. So yeah. Kelly and you as well. So if we do
I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this.
Run programming than me. Generally, I'm just taking someone from no running to like, can they get back to 20, 30, 40 minutes of jogging? And that's probably about it. I don't really write to too many programs. But it would generally look like modifying one of the three, which would be intensity for a week, intensity or frequency or volume. For myself, I just tend to take away the intensity. As we said, the thing with bone stress injuries is they are most susceptible when we add the higher magnitude of loading, which is basically just faster running. So I'll just take out all my faster running and just jog still as normal. And I'll still hit the same amount of volume. I just don't do as much intensity. So I still might run 80 Ks a week, but I don't do a session. I just jog. And I find in my head, that makes logical sense. Now, I did have a statistic that I looked at last night in preparation.
You love an A.
I do love a stat because that's from a study. But it's based off some animal models. It's not in human trials. It's not prospective research. But the fatigability of bone, so your bone has a fatigue amount that it can tolerate before it becomes potentially more susceptible to a bone stress injury. But as you increase your magnitude by up to 10%, that can almost halve the fatigability rate of your bone, which is incredible. So if you just go 10% quicker, your bone may fatigue 50% faster, which is just incredible. Now, again, that's not in humans, but you get what I'm talking about with the magnitude. Cool. That's me finished.
Interesting. Nice.
Yeah, I think it depends on the runner. I work with an elite runner, Joe Ryan, and I know that on his deload weeks, he'll still include some sessions because he's a very experienced runner, has been running for a long time. So that's different. But the running that I would do for myself and for patients, I'd take away any intervals and I just do an easy or moderate jog with some strides for that kind of session. And then the rest of the week would be easy jogging. I'd also back off their long run as well. So if they had been running up to 20 kilometers, I might get them to run like 15 kilometers that week instead, or even less, perhaps, just depending on how they're feeling. And I always make a note for that week to just be really prioritizing sleeping and eating well and recovering and feeling good. If you wake up one day and you don't feel like running, then don't. Just have it as a nice rest and recovery week is what I would do. But I do include strides still throughout the week. I think strides are a good way to just keep a little bit of speed and keep it interesting.
What do you do, Soph?
I'm different. I'm way more on the volume train. So I would still keep some intensity there, but I would drop volume. So say, let's just do a real basic example. If someone's running 50 Ks in the week and their long run is 15 Ks, and then they're doing, what's the mass on that? 35 Ks throughout the week. I would drop that down to like 30 Ks from 50 to 30 and still keep some intensity. So if their session had previously been 8 lots of 600s, I'd get them doing 200s at a slightly slower pace. So slightly less intense, but still keeping some speed in the legs. I think obviously it depends on what their goal is and all those things. But I would, I'm much more focused on reducing volume. I'd add an extra rest day in, cut their long run down a little bit. But I'd still keep a little bit of intensity. So yeah, it's really interesting to hear your perspective. I'm definitely going to think about that a little bit more because I've always just kind of looked at it as like total volume and total amount of work and what are we doing throughout the weeks leading up to that, and just giving the body, I guess, less time or less duration to, like, I think my question to you would be about the intensity. If you were traditionally doing a session that was worth 6Ks, so instead of that you're doing a 6K jog, I guess then you're spending more time on your feet, right? So your total duration is probably more than what it would typically be. Is that an issue, do you think?
Yeah, well, from what the research, but from that Stuart Warden paper, which, you know, you definitely got to read that if you listen to this. It's an awesome paper. But he was basically saying that, you know, bones themselves are really quite resilient to just our general load of loading cycles. So if you go for and take 5,000 steps or 5,000 steps over a run, your bone is going to be pretty good if it's at an easy pace. Whereas with the magnitude, that is when it really fatigues and it is more likely to accumulate that micro damage. So even if you're doing 3x1K, the higher, and again, this is just an arbitrary, but say you're doing 3x1K really quick, really high magnitude of loading, really pushing down. And I'll talk about the tibia, high plantar flexor forces, lots of tensile compressive force in the tibia. You know, that the argument could potentially be that then going out for a 5 or 6K slow, easy run would actually be less, cause less damage, I'd say, to the bone potentially. Now, that's just an arbitrary number, but that's kind of what I'm saying. But in saying all this, you guys are way better at experts in run programming than me. And the clinical stuff is, then the research doesn't always translate like that to actually clinically and helping people in any way. So listening to this, listen to Soph and Kelly, not me.
No, I think it's interesting. I think it's really worth thinking about.
Yeah, I think, you know, you could look at if someone runs 30 kilometers in the week, there's different spectrums of 30 kilometers in the week. Like you could really cook yourself running 30 kilometers a week if you were doing all of it at a high intensity. And then there's 30 kilometers a week of running, of easy running and jogging. And I think that if you've I guess what I'm trying to say is the amount of stress that goes through the body with intensity, I think is a whole lot higher opposed to when you're controlling that effort level. I think that is certainly more of a deload week by reducing that effort level and that stress in my mind.
Yeah, both physiological and mental, I guess, cognitive, just doing intensity sessions.
Mm. Well, I think that mental comes into it as well, because I think I know a lot of my runners would struggle to not have any fast stuff. Like, I think there's something about, especially if you're training for something that's quick, the feeling of running quick. And if you take that away and it's all jogging, I think people would struggle with that. But I think some would have more buy-in to be like, okay, cool, I can still do, whether it's strides or 200s or something short, like the volume's less, they're not doing as much of the intensity. It wouldn't be as quick, but they're still able to have that same feeling, but you've still reduced that overall volume by half or whatever it is. So it's an interesting one.
Yeah. And if that makes them feel better, if you do feel better from that, do you potentially feel better? Do you potentially sleep better? Do you have a potential better week? And those factors influence, burn, turnover, recovery, and that kind of thing. So it's cool, we don't have the answers yet.
The other thing that I've done in the past, which might be a blend of the two, is have little like time trials at the end of the week. So have the whole week a whole lot easier. And then I was doing this with Ham with her programming.
Oh yeah, you and I do it. You do a time trial when I go out for an easy jog. Come on, you no.
Hey, you can't say that to me. I've got a phone strike.
She's vulnerable.
I wanted to say that about the Sydney surf race, but you moved on too quick, so I had to think on the way.
You got it in there, don't worry.
But yeah, like on the back end, I'd like almost blend their long run in with a time trial, like have like a 20-minute warm up, 20-minute cool down, and then do like a 5K park run time trial on the back end of their deload week for some amount of speed, and just as using that as a sort of like a check-in point and monitoring how they're progressing and how they're recovering or like responding to the training program as well. It's nice to see those little incremental improvements.
I
like
good. It
that's cool. I like that. We're gonna have to wrap up, I'm sorry, but I
we've been speaking for a while. I
thoroughly enjoyed the chat. Life. Thank you so much. I learned a lot. I'm sure the listeners also learned heaps as well, and if they are feeling inspired and keen to learn more, they can check out your podcast. It'll be linked below. Follow the Instagram page as well for all of Kelly's fantastic content that she puts out.
Definitely.
Yeah. Thank you so much, guys. That was so much
fun.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having you, Soph. We love listening to your podcast as well. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's really, really good.
Definitely.
Thank you so much. All right. We will chat soon.
See you later.